All right, morning. Numbers chapter 16. So fourth book of the Bible, chapter 16. As I was talking with Chuck earlier, not one of those really terribly well-known books of the Bible. We're going to work through it in some pieces today. So normally I would just read the entire passage, start to finish as we begin. It's 50 verses long. And instead of starting that way and maybe losing some of the pieces of it, I figured we'll read the entire thing as we work through it together. So we'll do that a little bit different today. How do you approach God? Have you ever asked that question or thought about that question? Like, how do you actually do it? And once you start asking yourself questions about what does it look like to approach God, other questions begin popping up, right? So how do you approach God? Well, that depends on who you think God is. If he's the guy that lives at the top of the mountain, then I guess you climb a mountain, right? If he's the voice on the inside of you, then you turn inward, right? How do you approach God? And every religion is going to answer this question with some degree of difference, right? The Buddhist conception of what God, I put God in scare quotes there, God is or looks like would be different than the Christian view. We're going to be blinded sometimes to the privileges that we have in Christ because we're so used to how we think about approaching God in the present age through Christ that we forget some of the difficulties that have been before. Maybe you ask the question of where do you approach God, right? You approach God by going out in nature. Do you go down to your basement? Do you have to be near water, right? Who knows why? How did you come to the conclusion you did about how and where you can approach God? Or the last question, who can approach God? So we ask the question of how do you approach God? Where do you approach God? Who is a question that we are inherently uncomfortable with as Americans. Who can approach God? Anybody. Everybody's allowed to approach God. There's like an American impulse here, a democratic thing that says everybody gets to approach God. That's a very Christian understanding of what it looks like to approach God, right? All that is rested on the way that the world is under Christ. So we're going to step into the past, number 16, so that we can maybe see the present a little bit more clearly. So number 16 is really going to help us with this. It's going to give us some great benefits. Number 16, when you are done, when we are done here, Lord willing, you're going to be able to read particular parts of Scripture better and more richly. They will have more meaning for you because of Numbers chapter 16. And number 16 is a story of a rebellion. R.C. Sproul famously said that sin is cosmic treason. What that is saying is sin itself is rebellion. That's how everything starts. The story of the world, creation, begins in a garden with people who rebel, right? And everything is downhill from that. They're kicked out of the garden. And from then on, humanity is looking for access to draw back, to go back to the garden. Eden is on a hill. It's on a mountain. It's why most religions consider high places where you go to get close to the gods, right? That doesn't matter if we're talking Greek mythology, Roman mythology, African mythology. Like, the gods are located at high places and at trees and in gardens. Why? Because this is the way the world was made. So we're going to go ahead and begin to dive into the story. As we do, one last thing to put into your head, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 reminds us the Old Testament was written for us, right? Do not think that the Old Testament isn't for us. We're believers, we're in the New Testament, we don't need the Old Testament. No. Full stop there, that is not true. The Old Testament is for us. It's to strengthen us and to encourage us. So we're going to review the story really quick here. Let's find our place because we are jumping into the middle of the book of Numbers with no warning. So Geronimo, here we go, right? Okay, so Israel has been rescued out of slavery in Egypt. That's the first half of the book of Exodus. They leave Egypt. They cross this little wilderness, the Red Sea, all this, and they wind up at Mount Sinai. They're at Mount Sinai from Exodus chapter 19 up through Numbers chapter 10, and it takes a year. So in your head, when you're thinking about the story of the Bible, you should think Exodus 19, the rest of the book of Exodus up through chapter 40, all of the book of Leviticus, and the first 10 chapters of Numbers, that is all happening at one place, Mount Sinai. Things finish up. They get the directions for the tabernacle to construct it. They get the directions for how the priesthood is going to work. God's law is given. All those things come together, and then Israel sets out. And they set out from chapter 10 of Numbers through chapter 20 in the wilderness of Paran, or in other places it's called Kadesh Barnea, right? They're headed into the desert, into the wilderness, on their way to the promised land. Things are bumpy. Things do not go well. They leave Sinai, and there are other rebellions. There are the entire debacle of going in to look at the promised land. They send in the 12 spies, 10 of them. Hey, there's no way we're going to be able to do this. There's giants there. Two of them are like, you guys forget what just happened in Egypt. God judges. And then the people are like, look, we're not going to go into the land. And God goes, cool, you're right. You don't think you can go in? Fine, don't go in. I'll let you all die in the wilderness. I'll take the next generation in. So things are not off to a swimmingly good start in the book of Numbers. You get to chapter 15 and you get this weird flash forward moment, right? If you're ever reading Chronicles of Narnia, in the Chronicles of Narnia, there's a point where Lewis is writing, and he's writing this book for kids. And at some points, he was afraid the kids would get scared. So he has his character say, in the future, when we remember this moment, which communicates to them, like, everybody survived. We look back on this. Calm down. Like, there's stress, but Numbers 15 does the same thing. It goes, hey, when you guys get there, here's how we're going to do things in the Promised Land. So it flashes you forward and says, no. You guys have been rebels and horrible and disobedient. And yet, the promises of God are still a thing. You are still going to make it. So he flashes them forward. That's Numbers chapter 15. And then we hit chapter 16. Something I want to put on your radar, if you ever decide to sit down and read the book of Numbers, is what really matters is the camp. So the camp is like a renewed Eden. So the structure of the camp, the pieces of the camp, the presence of God with his people all around him is like Eden. In fact, at the end of the book, you're going to hear some oracles from a guy called Balaam, and he literally describes the camp of Israel just like Eden. So pay attention as you're going through Numbers, where the thing in front of you is happening. Is it happening on the outskirts of the camp, just on the outer edges? Is it in the midst of the camp? Or is it at the edge of the camp, right at the tabernacle? Today, our passage is that transition point between the center of the camp and being at the tabernacle, and they blend together. All right. So with that, for an easy, simple, fast introduction, we'll look at this in four pieces, okay? First, we want to look at the rebels and their reasons, right? What reasons do they have? Second, we want to look at the results of the rebellion. Then we're going to think about rebellion that spreads. And finally, we'll close it with the cure of rebellion. So, rebels and their reasons. Starting at verse 1, Numbers chapter 16. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, we'll stop there for a second. Okay? I think what you should have playing in your head is the start of an MMA fight. Let's get ready to rumble, right? And then what do? They describe the two teams, right? And in the blue corner we have, and in the red corner we have, that's exactly what you have here, right? So in the red corner you have Korah. He's a Kohathite. Cool. Thanks for telling us. Really appreciate that. That's super helpful. No, he's a Levite, right? He's from the clan of Levi. And then he's got Dathan and Abiram and On. Oh, those guys are Reubenites. Okay. Also, 250, the best way to phrase it is 250 nobles. These are like princes of Israel, guys that rule, that are well known. So you got a bunch of people in one corner. And in the other corner, Moses and Aaron, right? So it doesn't seem like a fair fight to begin with, but here we are. But they're gathered against Moses and against Aaron. And if we opened with let's get ready to rumble, this would be the moment when Big John comes out and says, let's get it on. So, you have gone too far, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? When Moses heard it, he fell on his face, and he said to Korah and all his company, in the morning, the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses, he will bring near to him. Do this. Take censers, Korah and all his company, put fire in them, and put incense on them before the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the holy one. You've gone too far, sons of Levi. And Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them, and that he has brought you near him, and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you? And would you seek the priesthood also? Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and all your company have gathered together. What is Aaron that you grumble against him? All right, so now we've got the issue out, right? It's at least public. You've gone too far. Literally, the Hebrew is, you take too much. Moses, Aaron, you guys have taken it all. You're being greedy. What's the deal? You think you're a big deal? Everybody is as special as you. That's the claim, which is such an American way to phrase the priesthood, right? Oh, everybody's as good as you, Moses and Aaron. Everybody should have a shot at this. Everyone has the right to the priesthood. Everyone has the right to offer. The entire congregation is holy. And in one sense, that's absolutely true. In fact, in chapter 15, at the very end of the chapter, all of Israel is told to put like blue tassels on their garments that remind them to think about and follow God's commands. And it's a reminder that they're all holy. So Korah's drawing on something here, and he's saying, look, everybody's as holy as you. Why do you think that you get to play this role? Why do you get to be in charge? This democratic impulse is so present here. If you're not familiar with a censer, imagine like a really large plate that's just slightly concave. And they put incense in it, and they light it on fire, and it burns, and it makes clouds of sweet-smelling smoke. And they would take it into the temple and the tabernacle. So that's what they're offering. They're saying it's an offering before God. But I want you to notice that verse 11 there, what is Aaron that you grumble against him? This first battle, this first charge is against Aaron. Moses and Aaron are a team, but Aaron is singled out here. Korah is focused on the priesthood. Why are you taking him on, Moses wants to know. What's the deal? Why are you after that? And this is where we need a little bit more background. So background is actually super critical here. The Levites, right, tribe of Levi, the Levites, the ones who serve at the temple. So you have the priests, that's Aaron, the descendants of Aaron, and then you have the Levites. That's a clan, and they help, and they serve at the temple. The Levites replaced the firstborn of Israel. This is not something I had really clearly sketched out in my own head. And as the more you dive into this passage, the more it plays a super critical role. So imagine this. Israel gets out of Egypt, and if they were going to do tabernacle service at that time, if they had had the tabernacle, every firstborn son from every family would participate in helping at the tabernacle or serving at the temple. And as the story goes along, that right is taken away from the firstborn sons and given to the clan of Levi. Right? Three times in Exodus, the firstborn are given support duties, the priestly support duties, and then three times in Numbers, just so that they mirror one another, those rights are taken away and given to the clan of Levi. So now let's revisit Korah, right? I gave you your initial, who are we going to meet in this corner? Oh, it's Korah, the Kohathite, right? We could phrase him a different way. We could call him Cousin Korah. He's literally Moses' first cousin, right? So Moses thinks he's a big deal, and he's got a family member who's like, hey man, same clan, bro. Like, are you really that big of a deal? You're Levi. I'm Levi. Why the favoritism? Why do you get to lead and I don't? So he's a firstborn son as well. Exodus chapter 6 makes that clear so that you know not only is he of the clan of Levi, he's a firstborn son. He should have had the right to be getting to do some of this service and this offering. But Korah is a passed over man. Korah is not even the leader of his clan, the Kohathites, right? It should be him. He's the second in line. The first in line has already been grabbed. So it should be Korah in charge of the Kohathites, a particular group of sons. And it's not. It's the fourthborn son. And so he's been passed over by a guy called Uzziel, right? Or no, sorry, Elizaphan. And you find that out in Numbers chapter 3. Korah has got some reasons to be frustrated. And then on top of that, go ahead and stack in the fact that these 250 leaders that are gathered here as well, they're probably the firstborn sons of Israel. Right? There's good reasons in other texts as you assemble them to say these are probably a bunch of firstborn sons who used to have or would have had the rights of serving at the temple and the tabernacle and now don't. Right? So they used to be able to help with these things. And that means they probably have carried the censers before. They've probably done some kind of priestly duty. That was a common way for the firstborn son of the family to lead in those priestly duties. So what's the response? Moses says, copy, I understand what your concerns are. The Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and he'll bring him near. In fact, let's do a test. And so what's he do? He throws down the gauntlet. You think you can serve as a priest? Let's do it. You bring your guys and your censers, and I'll bring Aaron and his censer, and we'll line it up, and we'll see what happens. And the Lord will bring the one close to him who is holy. Now, you should be thinking anytime somebody says, hey, I want to bring censers to the tabernacle, to God, as an offering, you should be hearing two names come to mind, Nadab and Abihu. Aaron had two sons, and they thought, hey, I can do this when I want under my terms, and God destroys them. They're consumed by fire. So, gutsy move on the part of Korah and his guys to be like, we know that you lost your two sons for offering fire unauthorized. That's the way that Leviticus phrases it. We know that, but we think we're all equal and we're all good. We'll take your challenge. So Moses and Aaron says, cool, you get your censers, you show up at the tabernacle, we'll have a worship war, right? Let's see who can do the better offering. Let's see how this goes. And the focus, once again, this is on Aaron. This is focused on Aaron's priesthood. But I want to stop for a second, and I want to think about what's going on below the surface here, right? There's sin underneath the sin. So rebellion might be the big topic that we label in the chapter. It's how this event is remembered in Scripture. But sin always travels in packs, right? Sins are never alone. And in this case, you can think of sins, like wolves, they travel in packs, as having visible components and invisible components. And what I mean is, some sins are outward sins, right? If you commit adultery, that's an outward action that happens, right? But the sin that's underneath that sin is lust, and it leads you down that road. If you steal something and you commit theft, underneath theft is greed, right? So what's the sin, or at least in this case, what's the sin under rebellion? It's envy. Korah wants what Aaron has. And envy is a big deal. It's a dangerous sin. And envy's got like four pieces to it, and it's important that we recognize all four. The first thing that envy does is it compares. It lines up you and then someone else and says, look where they are, look where I am. And then it says, I want that. It desires. So I see where I'm at. I see where they're at. I want that. I want that thing there. And it nests itself in their heart and in their desires. And then do you know what envy does? It blinds you. Envy makes you blind. You can't see properly. This shows up in our passage here with the take too much language in verses 3 and 7. Moses is pushing back here and saying, you're saying you go too far, is how the ESV translates it, but you take too much. And he says, no, 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 I'm not the one taking too much. That would be you. And then his next phrase is, Korah, is it a small thing to you that the Lord took you out of all the tribes of Israel? Remember, Korah's a Levite. He gets to serve. He's not happy serving. He wants the high priesthood, but he gets to serve. He has downplayed the very gift and thing that he has. And he said it's insufficient. He's blinded to the special role that he's already received. So he's compared and he's desired, and then his sin blinds him. So what happens is he devalues what he's been given. That's how this goes for Korah. He compares, he desires, he's blinded. Stop there for 2 seconds. Isn't this how sin works for us? Right? Isn't this precisely how my own heart works? Right? I line up my life and I look at somebody else and I say, they have a better job, they have a better house, they make more money, they have more health, they have a better body, they have a better wife, they have something. And I go, look, there's a difference. And then my grasping heart goes, I want that. And what do? I get blinded and I neglect to notice the multitude of gifts that I've got, the job that I do have, the health that I do have, the family that I do have, like all these blessings that I have, I'm blind to them because envy blinds. That's what it does. So I'm now blind to them and I downplay the blessings that I do have. You know, this is as old as the garden, right? In the Garden of Eden, you literally have a garden of everything is available. Knock yourself out. All these trees, except that one. And what happens? Oh, there's one. If I could just have the one, right? That's where the sin comes in that desiring. There's a God-given cure for envy, though, right? There's something that like nips it in the bud. Do you know what that is? It's thankfulness. It's gratitude. Like, do not think that when you're commanded to give thanks, God is just like somebody who needs praise, right? Oh, I would really feel better about myself if that puny human that I created and sustained in all existence would tell me I'm good. That's not what's happening, right? That's not how that works. What is happening is God is offering us a generous cure for the sin and the envy in our hearts. When he says, give thanks, show gratitude, he's helping you to see, open your eyes. Don't be blind. You stand under a mountain of blessing and life, right? You climb into a car and you don't notice how good it is. You don't have to walk home. You head to a job and you don't realize the fact that you haven't been looking for work right now. You don't realize the fact that you walk out of the church on 2 feet, right? There's so many things, so many ways to compare that are actually favorable. And we must become grateful people, people who are thankful, so that our sin is curbed, is nipped in the bud. But I said there were four parts to envy. We compare, we desire, we get blinded by it. But the last piece about envy, envy's contagious. Envy spreads. It never stops. Right? The person who is envious affects all the people around them. And in this case, in the people of Israel, Numbers chapter 16, envy has metastasized. It's gone somewhere else. Verse 12. And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. And they said, "We won't come up. Is it a small thing that you brought us up out of the land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you must also make yourself a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." And Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, and I have not harmed one of them." So, it's important to the story that you know the layout of the camp, right? So the Levites are positioned around the tabernacle. They have different duties, and they're positioned around the tabernacle by clans. Different clans of Levi, different places that go around the tabernacle. Same thing goes for the people of Israel, but they're the next circle out. So the tribes of Israel are around the tabernacle. Guess which two are right next to each other? Kohathites, Reubenites. Like, it is very easy for me to imagine that they're sitting around the campfire at night and they're grumbling about what they don't have. "I should be a priest. I'm as good as Aaron." Yeah, not just that. We should be in charge too. That means that we have to take another look at what's going on with the complaint that you get from Dathan and Abiram. "We will not come up." That sounds like a petulant child. Moses says, "Come here." And they go, "No, won't do it." Okay. But their refusal to ascend, that's literally the "come up" is ascend. "We will not ascend" is an attack. It's an attack on Moses this time, not Aaron. They're telling Moses, "You don't have the authority to tell us to come somewhere. You're not in charge. We don't have to listen to you. You're an illegitimate ruler. I don't have to heed your summons. You're not a king." So it's an attack on Moses, and then it's a leadership challenge. Yeah, how are things going, Moses? Remember that whole promised land place that we were supposed to go to? Great job. Totally got us here. And then did you notice what they do? Talk about blindness. What do? They say Egypt was just like the promised land. You took us out of somewhere with milk and honey. And they mean Egypt. Because they tell you, you haven't yet taken us to the one that you promised. Wrap your head around that just for a second. You're in slavery for hundreds of years in Egypt. People die, babies are killed, you're worked to death, and you get out. You're like, what, 18 months at the most from escaping Egypt? And they're like, "Egypt was the promised land, man. Don't you remember how good it was?" What kind of stupidity are we talking about here, right? But the fact of the matter is what they are is they're now blinded by envy as well. Right? Envy has got its claws into them, and they're blind. They can't remember, and they can't see properly. And they think that Moses has been running things after his own will. So the attack on Moses is still tied to the priesthood, right? Moses is the one who says, under God's direction, that the firstborn are no longer the temple servants, the Levites are. And Dathan and Abiram, Reubenites, go, "Hey man, we think you're making your own changes." Right? You're doing this. This is not God's guidance, not his leadership. You're doing this. It's from your own sinful, greedy heart, not from the Lord. I mean, this got so bad in chapter 14 that the people got together and said, "Let's pick a new leader and go back to Egypt." That's Numbers chapter 14. We're a chapter and a half later, and here we are, and the people are like, "You're the problem, Moses. You haven't gotten it done. You promised us this land. You promised us this place. We haven't done it, and the place we came from, that's really the promised land." I do think there's a time and a place for us to reflect on the fact that we sometimes think that if we could just be outside of the good grace of God and go back to living for ourselves, that that would be the good land. If I could just be selfish, if I could just look out for me and not have to think about other Christians and other people and the work of Christ, like I could just live for my own pleasure, that's the promised land. That is a lie, right? You are blinded by your own sin if you think that. Us as our own gods is not a good place to be. But remember how we revisited Korah's lineage and that highlighted a couple things for us? Same thing goes on with Dathan and Abiram. They're Reubenites, right? That doesn't mean a ton to me when someone's like, "Hey, I'm a Reubenite." Cool. Good for you. Reuben is the firstborn son of the clans of Israel, right? So Jacob has his 12 sons. First son, Reuben. So if the firstborn son is the one that does all the priestly duties, literally serves as priests, then Dathan and Abiram, they are the first clan. They're the OG firstborn guys, right? And they don't get to have any of those duties. They're not in charge. They're not the ones running it. Shouldn't they be priests or at the very minimum, temple servants? They don't get any of those. Why? Because Moses said it goes to the Levites. They've got a bone to pick with Moses. You took something from us. You took the right that we should have had. They've been passed over for leadership as well. And isn't it odd that Moses is a Levite and picked Aaron, another Levite, to be the one? Like, oh, it's your clan, Moses? Cool, weird. Isn't that what every king does? Every king picks his buddies and takes his cronies and puts them into positions of power, just like you've done, Moses. You pick your people, your group, your clan, and you gave them the priesthood. You let them serve at the temple. You get to be in charge. What's the deal? We're the firstborn son, and firstborn sons matter. We're supposed to have rights. And they're blind, and they can't see what God has done and rescued them from. And then you get that little phrase at the end of their first charge there where they're like, what, are you going to put out the eyes of these men too? Which is a judgment that a king would do, right? He would blind an enemy. It would be an exercise, an evil exercise of his authority and his power. And it has this double anchor, right? Where you get this question, hey, Moses, are you going to blind these guys? Because we're not blind. We see what you're doing. You're exposed, Moses. We see your heart. Moses, you haven't followed through on the promises. You haven't gotten this done. So if Aaron is targeted for his role as a priest, Moses is targeted for his authority, the one who set up the priesthood and the one who's leading. And notice that in the text, we have the action happening in two places. You're at the tabernacle, that's where Korah's at, with the 250 leaders. And then you're at the tents with Dathan and Abiram, and they're not together. So it's really easy as you read the story to think like, oh, Korah's rebellion, it's like just everybody gathered together, it's one rebellion. No, it's two rebellions happening in two places that have the same root envy underneath. So that's why Moses had to call them. Hey, come here. They won't come here. Moses has to go to them. And where does he go? To the tents. Two rebellions. One centered on the tabernacle, one happening in the camp. Now, next verse, 15, 16, we flash back to the tabernacle. And Moses said to Korah, be present, you and all your company before the Lord, you and they and Aaron tomorrow. And let every one of you take his censer and put incense on it, and every one of you bring before the Lord his censer. 250 censers, you also and Aaron, each his censer. So every man took a censer and put fire in them and laid incense on them and stood at the entrance of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Then Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. So this section has got a little weird time element where the first couple of verses, hey, tomorrow when this happens, be ready. Here's the plan. Here's what you're to do. And then it flashes forward to the day. Hey, now that it's going on, Korah assembled everybody. Everybody's got their censer. Everybody's gathered. This is the place. And we're at the tabernacle. We are at the front of the tent of meeting. That's where this battle is going down. It's really critical that you notice, though. It doesn't come through in the English as well, but it's really emphatic that it's Korah versus Aaron with everybody around. So the 250 nobles are there, and they're participating, and they're clearly in Korah's camp. But when it says, you and they and Aaron tomorrow, it's Korah, you get your censer, Aaron will have his censer, and everybody else bring theirs. But they line it up, Korah and Aaron, Korah and Aaron, and the other people are participating, right? We want you to see, this is about, can Korah be the high priest or not? This is a battle between him and Aaron. He's no longer behind the scenes pulling the strings. He's not sitting around the campfire quietly grumbling at Aaron and Moses. He's getting called out. You don't get to hide in the corners anymore. Korah, you think you've got this? Then step up. Let's actually see it. No more hiding. And so he's called out to this. And the glory of the Lord appears. Yahweh arrives. And nothing is the same anymore. I started off describing this a little bit like a cage match, right? You get to meet the two opponents, red corner, blue corner, all that kind of stuff. In honesty, like, we're really setting that up poorly, right? It's not Moses and Aaron in one corner. It is Yahweh, the God of all creation, the one who just rescued his people out of Egypt and did all these mighty signs and wonders, and his two servants, Moses and Aaron, hanging out with him. But it's Yahweh in one corner opposed to Korah, Dathan, Abiram, On, and the 250 leaders. That's actually what the battle lines are. So when God shows up, this is not a little deal. Korah is badly mistaken. He thinks this is a battle over rituals and power and respect. I can do what you can do, Aaron. He's left God utterly out of his judgment. He has said, like, I can do what you do, and pretended that God hasn't spoken. The God that he's trying to say that he's going to serve and offer offerings to. Like, there's a degree of insanity, stupidity, like low IQ. I don't know what it is, but something there has Korah going, I can do this the way that I want to do this, and has neglected the very God that he's claiming that he could serve. Yahweh is left out of their thinking utterly. So, next section. What's the result of the rebellion? And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with all the congregation? And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to the congregation, get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. He is not playing, right? You can measure how serious this moment is by the Lord's response. And his response right off the bat is, I'm going to wipe them all out and start over, back up, right? He's not playing. He doesn't think this is a little thing that Korah is like, oh, Korah, I understand that you feel passed over and I'm sorry about that. None of that. God says, back up, Moses and Aaron. I'm about to do this thing. I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses and Aaron jump in and say what? No, Lord, not just because of one man's sin. Don't wipe them all out. Right? Some kind of grace and forgiveness here. It's so interesting that we have a battle over the priesthood and offerings and intercession. And what's the first thing that Moses and Aaron do when God expresses, hey, I'm going to judge these people? They intercede. They intercede for the rebels, just like that. Lord, no, don't wipe them all out. This has echoes for me of Abraham going to the town and saying, are you going to wipe out 50? What if there's 50 righteous? You're not that God, right? How about 45? How about 40, 30, 35, 15, 10? If there's 10 righteous. It has echoes of that with them going, are you going to wipe out everybody over one guy? And remember, it's not one guy. Whole congregation is gathered, 250 nobles, Dathan, Abiram, and On, and then Korah at the head. But they've pinned it all on Korah. Korah is the one behind this. He's the one that's at the center of this. Multiple players, one ringleader. And Moses and Aaron intercede. So what happens? Verse 25. Then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart, please, from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest you be swept away with all their sins. So they got away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents, together with their wives, their sons, and their little ones. And Moses said, hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die, as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belong to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. So, remember, we've got two places going on here. So, confrontation with Korah at the tabernacle, and Moses does what? He gets up and he leaves. They rose and they went. Now we're back to the tents. Now we're at the edge of the camp, right? Tabernacle, we've just headed back to the camp. We're at Dathan and Abiram's tents. So they weren't present at the tabernacle. He walked back to where they are. Remember, we won't come up. We don't have to listen to you. Fine, I'll come to you. So he comes and he gets to the tents and they're all grouped together. Remember, side by side, Kohathites, Reubenites, that poisonous envy spreading all through there. And then there's an irony and a fittingness when it's time to judge, right? They say, we won't come up. We don't have to listen to you. And Moses says, understood. Won't come up? Fine. Go down. And it's in the text. It's emphatic. It's you won't ascend, then you'll descend. And your judgment will be fitting with the way that you have rebelled. You will descend into Sheol, into the realm of the dead, the grave, alive. God says, fine. Don't come up. You can go down. Notice Moses' reasoning, though. Verse 28. Right, so he points out in the text, hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. Moses is highlighting, hey, this kind of judgment underlines something for you guys. I didn't pick this. I didn't pick the Levites because I was trying to favor my clan. I didn't do this. I'm doing what God has commanded me to do. And if you think that I'm not, then stand back and watch the judgment. If it doesn't happen, you're right. But if it does, buckle up, because then all the changes that have happened weren't my plan, but were his. Verse 31, and as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, with their households and all the people who belonged to them, who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. So two judgments, not one, right? I always grew up thinking that Korah's rebellion was like, earth splits open, everybody gets swallowed. No. Dathan and Abiram, and everybody attached to them, their entire family units, swallowed alive. But a different judgment at the tabernacle. We have two places, we have two judgments. It's just that last verse gets highlighted, and the fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. Here's what I think is the surprise of the text. It's pretty defendable. I don't think Korah was swallowed alive by the earth. I think Korah was consumed at the tabernacle. That's where his challenge is at. That's what's going on. He offers the censer. He gets killed just like goes on with Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10. And on top of that, when this story gets reiterated or retold in the rest of the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy 11, Dathan and Abiram are swallowed by the earth. Korah is not mentioned. You go to Psalm 106, Dathan and Abiram are swallowed by the earth. Korah not mentioned. Both times this story comes back up, he doesn't get swallowed. His name doesn't get put there. So his name as the ringleader, this is Korah's rebellion. But the swallowing happens to the men in the camp, Dathan, Abiram, the Reubenites, who think, we want this role. But I think Korah is consumed by the fire. And notice what gets pointed out. The details in the text matter so much. God underlines the manner of death for Dathan and Abiram. It becomes a proving point for who Moses is. So Moses has this long thing. Hey, if I did this on my own, great, don't let this come true. If I did, here's the judgment. Everybody stand back. Let's see. Let's have a test of whether or not I'm actually speaking what I want to do or what Yahweh has said, right? So we spend lots of time on the manner of death for Dathan and Abiram, but the memory of death, that's clearly got to go into the camp for Korah. That's highlighted, because what happens next? Verse 36. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, to take up the censers out of the blaze, and then scatter the fire far and wide, for they have become holy. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, for they offered them before the Lord, and they became holy. Thus they shall be a sign to the people of Israel. So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers, which those who were burned had offered, and they were hammered out as a covering for the altar, to be a reminder to the people of Israel, so that no outsider who is not of the descendants of Aaron should draw near to burn incense before the Lord, lest he become like Korah and his company, as the Lord said to him through Moses. So, the lesson that you're supposed to walk away with here, when you look at Korah, is only God's chosen priests get to draw near. Nobody else. You can't pick it. You can't argue on the basis of where you're in your family line or anything like that. God's already picked the family line. He's already picked the unit. So this democratic impulse that says everybody's the same amount of holy and this should all work out is underlined in our passage to say, uh-uh, that's not how this works. No one who thinks they want to just randomly draw near may draw near. God has rules put in place. And it seems like when you get to this point, this is where the story should stop, right? You dealt with Korah, you dealt with Dathan and Abiram, earth opened up, fire came out, and then we have this thing set aside for memory. Take those censers, hammer them down, cover the altar. Everyone who shows up is going to see that now. We have a memorial right there. And it's recertified Moses and Aaron, right? It's certified Aaron as the one who offered and wasn't consumed, and it certified Moses, the one who picked Aaron and said, this is what God has said, here's the priest. Both ends of the rebellion have been dealt with, right? Every offering contains in it now the memory of death and judgment, except for that last little part of envy, that it's contagious, right? And we thought that maybe envy had only spread as far as the Reubenites, but that's not the case. Rebellion that spreads. Verse 41. But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron, saying, you have killed the people of the Lord. And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting. And behold, the cloud covered it. And the glory of the Lord appeared. And Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from the midst of this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. The people of Israel have not learned the lesson. Right? They're still attributing to Moses and Aaron some kind of illegal, evil authority, right? Who killed the people? Right, when the earth split open and an entire group of people were swallowed alive and then the fire came out of the tabernacle, whose fault is that? It's yours, Moses and Aaron. That's crazy, right? Like, they literally just had this happen. They have seen all these miracles from God. All of these different things have happened. And the conclusion is, Moses and Aaron are crooked. You're the problem. You did this. Korin, Dathan, Abiram, and the nobles all challenged Moses and Aaron, and now the people are infected with the exact same sin. This rebellion has grown out. It's metastasized one more time. But let's continue on. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put fire on it from the altar and lay incense on it and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." So Aaron took it, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. All right, that's the end of the entire chapter. Remember that the original debate was over censers. Who can offer fire? Who can offer incense? And the conclusion is, as they're challenging Moses and Aaron, what happens? Moses and Aaron intercede on behalf of the people of Israel. Aaron, literally, the one that they're saying, everybody can do what you can do, and they just had it proved that that's not the case. Aaron doesn't say, "I'm not doing it this time. Let the plague roll." Right? Which would be an incredibly understandable thing if it was just up to Aaron. But it's not. He has a task. He has a role on behalf of God. He references before the people his mediatorial role. So what does he do? He follows Moses' instruction. He runs out there and he stops the plague. Now, plague is not an accidental thing here. It's not that God was like, "Well, I've done fire and I've done earth. Maybe we should go with wind and we have a band." No, it's not that, right? He goes with plague because plague is, out of Numbers chapter 8, precisely what the Levites protect the people from. The word plague shows up. When the Levites serve, they protect and they guard the tabernacle so that if the people of Israel come too close, they prevent a plague from going on them. The people of Israel are pushing too close and they're arguing with Moses and Aaron and a plague breaks out. This is Numbers chapter 8 being pulled forward and dropped into chapter 16. And what happens is Moses and Aaron intercede on their behalf. And this actually isn't all the way over. Chapter 17 is the last piece of dealing with, is Aaron really the guy? We don't have time for that. We've already done 50 verses. We're going to call it good here. So it's the last episode, though, of God dealing with Aaron's role in the eyes of the people. Now, what in the world are we supposed to do with a story like this? Right? We're a bunch of Christians. I don't have a tabernacle that I go to when I kill an animal weekly. I don't have a guy down the street who's a Reubenite. Right? I do not know Dathan and Abiram. I want to take a step back and say, with all the darkness and judgment and evil in the text, focus on some themes of goodness and excellence, right? There's actually good things going on here as the story traces out across the rest of Scripture. So the cure for rebellion. First and foremost, as should always be the case, we want to look at Christ. The cure for rebellion is wrapped up with Jesus. Who can draw near? Only God's anointed. That's the point of the passage. But there's a better anointed one coming. One who can draw near because of who he is. And so every Israelite from this point forward, Numbers chapter 16, who comes to offer sacrifices is reminded of the dangerous nature of the place. Right? Every time they come to the altar, they're literally looking at the bronze covering that says, "That was Korodine. That was 250 guys. They probably knew them." Right? Oh, that reminds me of Ethan. He was consumed by fire. He thought he could be a priest. He thought he got to pick, right? They come to the offering place, and it's a dangerous place. every Israelite is reminded of that. That's verse 40. It's to be a reminder to the people of Israel so that no outsider who is not of the descendants of Aaron should draw near to burn incense before the Lord, lest he become like Korah and his company. The presence of God is threatening and dangerous and glorious. It's dangerous to us, right? When they're kicked out of Eden and they can't return, there's a cherubim placed there, right? With a flaming sword, fire and knife. Fire and knife is what happens at a tabernacle, right? They cut and they burn the animal. They're passing back through. You're re-entering the Garden of Eden. That's what offerings are. But you can't do this. You can't exist in the presence of God because his holiness is of a level and of a kind that would consume you. The sin that is part of who we are in our nature means that we would be destroyed by him. In the same way that you can't turn the light on and have shadows just hang out on the floor. Light destroys shadows. That's what it does by its very presence. Same thing happens in the presence of God. You want to wander into the tabernacle? You'll be annihilated by his radiant, moral, perfect goodness. You can't deal with it. In the same way that a snowball can't go hang out in front of the sun, right? And just exist at the core of the sun because the sun's very nature destroys the snowball. The presence of God is dangerous to us. And so he shields it with the tabernacle. He shields it with his priests. And he has guards, the Levites, who keep people away so they're not wiped out. And when you walk into the New Testament, what do you find out? It's open. Something has changed. It's not an arbitrary danger. It's the danger of being. God is not a grumpy father who says, I don't let most of my kids come close to me. And if they do, I smack them. That is not what this God is like. He says, don't come close. I will destroy you by my very goodness and my very being. And so he gives them ways to be as close as possible without being destroyed. But the answer is, that's not how the story ends. Because the gospel is that instead of us drawing near, he draws near. He comes close. So Jesus comes and enters into humanity. And the God-man Christ lives and dies and is resurrected again. But wrap your head around the pieces of his story, right? He descends into Sheol. But this time, it's in judgment, but not for him. And it's not in defeat. And then when he gets up from the dead, right? We don't say he's swallowed by the earth, story's over, thanks for playing. What does 1 Corinthians say? Death is swallowed up in victory. Right? Hey, death, where's your sting? And the work of Christ, the more you meditate on it, like, changes everything. Like, touches everything. So what are the words of Hebrews 10 for us, right? Hebrews, essentially Hebrews, is taking the entire Old Testament system and just saying, let me show you how Jesus is better, right? You could pretty much just read every chapter from, I don't know, second half of Exodus, all Leviticus, most of Numbers, and then just read Hebrews after every chapter, and you would start to have a better understanding of, like, oh, that's what he's doing, right? So what does Hebrews chapter 10 say? Let us draw near to God. Like, just stop there for a second. We roll right past that. We think, let us draw near to God, and we're like, yeah, like, we're Christians. We want to be close to God. No. The whole point is that Christ has done something to allow us to draw near that is unthinkable in the Old Testament. What do you mean you get to walk into his presence? What do you mean you're called his son, adopted into his family, that you have his presence and his place and his spirit given to you? Let us draw near to God with sincere hearts and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. Come close. Every Israelite who came looked at the bronze on the altar and went, it's dangerous here. And you and I waltz in like it's not a thing. I don't think that's supposed to be that way. Recognize we have a greater danger. Hebrews makes this case as well. You can reject Moses and you wind up like Korah, Dathan, Abiram, those guys. Reject Christ? It's a different degree of problem, right? It's a so much more than argument. Moses was great. They rejected him. Look how it went. Jesus is how much greater? You think you can reject him and have it be okay? There's a threat contained in the possibility of you wandering from Christ, you turning from Christ, you going back to a false system. Think about this through the lens of Psalm chapter 2. I love that you read Psalm 2, right? Why do the heathen nations rage? They are gathered together against the Lord's anointed. That's our story. Our story today is Moses and Aaron. People gathered against the Lord's anointed. It went poorly. That story, though, that quote from Psalm 2 is going to get picked up in Acts chapter 4 with Christ. Surely they were gathered together in this city, Herod, Pilate, the people, against Jesus, your anointed. And they did everything that you had already planned they were going to do, God, and then you got him up from the dead. You put your stamp of approval on the work of Christ and said, accepted. And the Son gets up from the dead. And that means, because he got up from the dead, that you and I are accepted. That the faith that we've been given is now freely exercised in life and in joy and in community. Envy itself is undone, right? If you think of Korah as grasping for the priesthood, you look at Jesus doing precisely the opposite. If the cycle of envy is, I compare and then I desire, what does Jesus do? He compares and then he gives. The math runs the opposite direction. He looks at us and goes, I'll humble myself and become obedient to the point of death. I will not stay exalted, wipe them out, play a different game. I will see where they're at, humble myself, become obedient to the point of death. That's how Jesus takes the whole concept of envy and just unwinds it. There's other things in this story, though. It's worth tracking across the scope of the Old Testament. Like, here's weird questions for you. What happened to On? Right? Story starts off with Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On, right? There's a random Reubenite who is only mentioned in the first verse. Jewish legend says that he actually listened to his wife's rebuke and fled from the tent. We have no idea if that's true. I don't hate it, but I can't tell you anything about it. I can tell you that he's not listed in any of the judgments. Something changed for him. But here's the other weird thing, right? Everyone who belongs to Korah gets wiped out. Right? The text is like super clear. Everybody who belongs to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram consumed. And then everybody offering incense burned by fire, right? Story's over. Thanks. That family line is gone. Except it's not. You're going to get to Numbers chapter 26 and you're going to find out God didn't wipe out Korah's sons. They didn't die. Now, it lists wives, little ones, like family units are there. Sons aren't. What does that mean? I honestly think it can only mean one thing. Korah's sons walked away from the family. Give me another solution that makes sense here. There isn't one that I can find. Wrap your head around that for a second. This is where I would definitely want to bring this home here. Fathers. I'm going to speak very clearly to the fathers for a second. Have you knit your children to you or to Jesus? And to put an exceptionally fine point on this, dads, if you walked away from Christ, would your kids follow or stay? Because I think Korah's kids left. Or better yet, to say it better, stayed. And Korah left. Your family history is not a verdict. Family heritage can be overcome. Even Korah's sons got it right. And their story doesn't end there. And this is some of the stuff that I love. 1 Chronicles 9 tells you that Shalom, who's a great-grandson of Korah, and his kinsmen are put in charge of the work of the service, keeping the thresholds of the tent, right? They're doorkeepers at the tabernacle. They wind up working in the temple. 1 Chronicles 12, Korahites, sons of Korah, wind up in David's mighty men, right? So the story tracks out that there's redemption in the midst of the story. But the piece that I love, Korahites become psalm writers and singers. We read two of their psalms today, right? So Psalm 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 84, 85, 87, and 88 are all psalms of the sons of Korah. Go back and read those, but put this lens, Numbers 16, on them, right? So what do you hear in Psalm 46? Though the earth give way, they saw it. It really did. Though the earth give way, And yet here they stand. Forgiven, redeemed, cared for. Or Psalm 84, a psalm of the sons of Korah. I'll just start at verse 10. Remember, these are gatekeepers in the house of God. For a day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. They're literally saying, better to be the door guy than to aim for what Korah did. I don't want that. I'll be content here. For the Lord God is a sun and a shield. The Lord bestows favor and honor. No good thing does he withhold from those who walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man who trusts in you. This story also shows up in the New Testament. It's referenced in a couple different places, but there's a couple that are worth highlighting for us. So 2 Timothy chapter 2, it's alluded to. So if you were to do some translational things, you could say that they look like they're quoting from number 16, but it's not exact. So you can't say it's a quotation of, but it's definitely a clear allusion to. 2 Timothy chapter 2, after warning that talk will spread like gangrene, Paul alludes to Korah and says, "The Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of the Lord depart from iniquity." Guard your speech is an acceptable application of the story of Korah. Grumbling and murmuring and envy are not how we're supposed to be. It's not who we're supposed to be. Kids, it's easy to think that grumbling doesn't matter. I'm allowed to whine. Korah disagrees. This story says that's not how this goes. Jude then picks it up and quotes the story of Korah and says, that's an example of somebody pursuing power and authority and falling into error and destruction. And Jude warns you against it. Numbers chapter 16 has some serious lessons for us. It's worth dwelling on and thinking on, chewing it over and applying it to our lives. May we guard our speech and our lives and our hearts because of the work of Christ. Let me pray for us. Heavenly Father, you are the God who has drawn near. You have drawn near to us in the work of your Son, and we have seen how much we need it and the dangers of us trying to draw near without you. Father, I ask that you would take your word and imprint it in our hearts and in our minds. Help us to love you. Keep us from the cycle of envy that would blind us and ruin us and destroy us and those we love. Father, would you protect this congregation from that evil? And would they be knit together in love because of the work of your Son, the truer and better Aaron, and the truer and better Moses? In Christ's name. All right, communion. One, we need another, we have two. Cool.